Okay.
Okay, welcome to the MacGuffin Man. I'm Alex, and with me, as usual, is James.
Listen to the excitement in your voice.
Amped up about this movie. Check out our website, MacGuffinMen.com. We've had a pretty busy summer, except for that month where we didn't do anything, but we've talked about The Man with No Name. We most recently talked about Harriet the Spy. We also talked about True Detective Season 2. Going Clear and Mission Impossible Rogue Nation in the same podcast. So you can check all of those things out at themacguffinmen.com. Follow us on Twitter at themacguffinmen, and subscribe to us on iTunes. Our next couple podcasts after this one are going to be about Blade, and then 2 weeks after that, Seinfeld. So very similar topics, obviously. It's a theme. But keep an eye out for those. Anyway, that's not what we're talking about today. So we'll get to that.
Welcome to the MacGuffin Man. And now, here are Alex and James.
All right, James.
Yep.
What are we talking about today?
Straight out of Compton.
Too much vigor. Like, just slightly too much vigor in the way you said that.
Okay. Straight out of Compton.
There we go.
The NWA biopic?
Yes.
Our second biopic?
I don't know. What was the other one we did?
Did we do Walk the Line?
No, we didn't do Walk the Line.
I just know you're such a big fan. I assumed
yep.
you did.
Oh, God. You know I literally booed out loud the ending of that movie, right? Like, in a movie theater?
I do.
Just totally reflexively. Like, it's not like I was like, oh, boo. It was just like, oh, boo. Like, really quickly at the freeze frame ending of that movie. And James Mangold has done so many good things to me, and that is a huge misstep. I did not care for that film, and I especially did not care for that ending.
Okay.
But enough about 10-year-old biopics. Let's get to biopics that came out 3 weeks ago.
Yeah, let's do that. Yeah. You are someone who is a fan of at least Dr. Dre, probably NWA.
Yeah, I was never the biggest NWA fan ever, and I was always an Ice Cube guy. If you're going back through their catalog, like, Ice Cube I think is so good, and like, history has sort of made us lose track of how good Ice Cube was, but he's such a good rapper, and I think has had a very he was like Public Enemy, but without caring about anything. So it's like really angry music, but sort of in a detached sort of way, where Public Enemy, or at least Chuck D, was specifically like thought or was trying to make change happen. Ice Cube was just like, I'm just angry and I'm still going to make really boisterous, wonderful music. But I don't think it's ever going to change anything because, because I'm logical. But yeah, no, I'm well versed in hip hop and NWA's history, at least. And yeah, so I was curious to see this movie, despite my general hatred of biopics.
Yeah, I didn't really know your best guess of how this movie was going to turn out.
When I saw the trailer, my initial reaction to it was, this is going to be the biopickiest movie ever made. Like, I just sort of thought it would be incredibly formulaic, that whole like rise and fall sort of thing, and it's there, but it's also not, like, because this movie feels so disjointed. I don't know really what I was expecting, and actually the person that I was going to see it with the day before, we were talking about it, and I said I simultaneously feel like I know exactly how this movie's gonna be and have no idea what this movie's gonna be, you know, like, and I still kind of feel that way. Like, I know exactly what it is, but I also have no understanding of it. Like, it's more of a checklist than a movie. It seems like a series of events more than a film, you know, like loosely connected scenes.
Right. Okay. So when you say it's a checklist more than a movie. And I mean, you kind of just explained it there, but I want to get more of a, I want to dig into that a little bit, because there are times, you know, when like Tupac shows up or Snoop yeah. shows up, and, or I think the most egregious offense is that Ice Cube Road Friday, where they
that's the worst.
Shoehorning that fact into the screenplay, I think, is the worst. But what is it?
Well,
exactly,
and the thing
about?
Is, that, like, that scene could have been left, and then they just didn't have to address that he was writing Friday. You know, like, it could have shown him writing on a computer and, like, how are you going? It's like, oh, I'm on page 100. And then we all would have assumed it's Friday. But nope, this movie isn't into subtlety, it seems like.
Right.
Yeah.
Yes. I'll agree to that.
Yeah.
But I think people who went to see this movie, for the most part, and a lot of people went to see this movie,
mm-hmm.
Aren't they there for that checklist, kind of, isn't it? They want to relive the past and the what experiences they went through making this movie. I get what you say, that it where it feels disjointed and it's more about just, you know, hitting the right thing than it is making a cohesive movie. But don't you think there'd be a lot of disappointment if we didn't get all those things checked off?
Yes, but this is all. I think this also sort of speaks to my frustrations with the biopic genre in general. That these movies always kind of feel this way, with like these are the seminal events in these characters or these people's lives, and so we have to address them, and you know, we're going to sort of build a sort of rise and fall narrative out of these things, and. Yeah, I think what differs for me is I just don't like biopics. I find most people do, because most people kind of like that formula, and I've just grown very tired of it. So yes, people absolutely would have been frustrated if a lot of these things weren't included. But you know, it doesn't make it a better movie to me. You know, I made mention of this many times on the podcast, or at least to you in casual conversation. My favorite biopic is I'm Not There, which is the Bob Dylan biopic, where I think 7 different people play some variation of Bob Dylan. And I think that's sort of a more interesting way to tackle it. And obviously it's a very abstract movie, but that was precisely what I liked about it, was the fact that the elements of it that were a checklist weren't necessarily the focus of the movie. And it was just sort of a more creative way to approach not only this specific famous person's life, but also the way life goes for anybody, in that, you know, the person you are at 50 is not really all that similar to the person you are at 18, you know? And that's something I think biopics often lose track of, just because they try and keep this consistent character for this famous person, you know? Does that make sense?
Yeah, that makes some sense. But we're not going to see a lot of movies like I'm Not There.
No, God no.
Okay.
I'm not not saying that that is a... I mean, I'm Not There wasn't financially successful, you know?
Yeah.
So,
Are you surprised about how popular this movie has been?
No, not at all.
Why?
Well, there's one thing, like every time some movie comes out where people are like, oh, I'm so surprised at how it did boffo numbers at the box office. I'm so surprised. And like, this movie caters to an underserved market, underserved audience, right? It's
R-rated.
It is R-rated, but it's also it's a, you know, major release about black people starring black actors, which is uncommon, you know? And it's the same. It's sort of that the business model that Tyler Perry sort of capitalized on, is that there were so few black faces in prominent roles in Hollywood movies that oftentimes when a movie with any sort of push starring black people is released into, you know, cinemas, it's very successful, specifically because there are so few opportunities to see that on screen, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Are you surprised about the critical?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Okay. Well, we should say that it's been mostly positive. I mean, this movie is not without its detractors, but...
namely me and you?
Yeah. Well, generally received well. Some people taking it very seriously and some very high praise. Mm-hmm. What do you think? Can you account for that?
No. No, I can't. I think this movie is terrible.
Okay.
Yeah.
But don't you think kind of NWA's place in culture and hip-hop's place in culture can, you know, explain a lot of that away?
Yes, but like, yeah, it can, but I mean, people are still wrong, you know? Like, NWA is important. Dr. Dre, Ice Cube have both done things that are very near and dear to my heart. But like that alone doesn't make this a good movie, you know? Like just because the songs Straight Outta Compton and Fuck the Police are in this movie, both songs that I really, really enjoy. I still like the songs just as much, but I don't like the movie that they're contained in, you know?
Yeah, yeah, okay.
Yeah. And I think, like, again, that sort of, that I like that this movie is very successful, even though it's terrible, because I like the idea of a grand, successful movie that's specifically about hip-hop history. Like, the fact that it exists makes me happy. I desperately wish it was also a good movie, you know? Like, because I feel like this is the first... I do think this is the first movie of its kind where it were, you know, I generally liken hip hop's like mainstream acceptance with the election of Obama, basically. It's not like it's totally accepted, but it was very much building up in the 2000s. And, you know, Obama referenced Jay-Z lyrics a handful of times when he was running for president. And I people found it charming, and I think that that sort of has led to hip hop being more accepted on a wide level. And this movie is a further reflection of that, that this movie is made and released and successful. And that will always make me happy because I've spent so much of my life listening to this music and caring very much about this music. And, the fact that that mass culture is now accepting of it in a way that it hasn't been to this point is very interesting to me. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, Wesley Morris and Grantland said just the fact that this movie is released is kind of a cultural triumph.
Yes.
I mean, the fact that a movie made about a group whose initials stand for what they stand for, is, you know, not even just has a movie made about it, but a very mainstream movie and a very successful mainstream movie. But you said you're kind of a big fan of hip-hop history, and this is a movie about that. How do you feel about how accurate of a retelling this is?
I mean, I don't know. It's just sort of a general feeling throughout the movie that I feel like the movie is... looks a little too brightly on all three of our main characters. And I'm looking at our main characters being Eazy-E, Dre, and Ice Cube. Specifically because the movie is produced by two of those people and the other's widow. And I sort of feel like that, if only subtly, really colors the way that these people are treated in the movie. Like, certainly there are instances of each of these characters doing shitty things, but not nearly anywhere near as shitty I knew any of, like, all of them did, you know? So that is something that is just sort of pervasive through the movie, that I feel like none of the characters are ever shown as close to what my perception of them as people is, and especially of them as people at that time, you know? I feel like you can really see the perception of Dre and Cube sort of colored by them looking back at their own past and seeing now being, they're probably both 50, right? Or getting there.
I think Dre's exactly 50 right now.
Yeah, okay. I think Cube's 1 or 2 years younger than him. And them sort of like looking back at their actions as a 20, 21-year-old sort of thing and being like, man, I was an idiot, you know? And as anybody looking back at their 20s will do when they're that far removed from it. Because, again, like I said, you're totally different as a 50-year-old than you are as an 18-year-old. And I think there is some, you know, it's their perception of themselves mixed with how they actually want to be seen. Because as opposed to most biopics, this movie is not being made towards the end of Cube and Dre's life. You know, they still have a career to care about, and they still, perception of them matters. So they can't really come off as villains in this movie and have it not, you know, help their career, I guess, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
yeah, in talking about that, though, and I mean, because there's just so many legacies and estates and things to kind of protect in this movie, right?
Yeah, 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 exactly. And I mean, from the perspective of Eazy-E, you know, you've got his widow looking back at him. You know, he died, I think, 20 years ago. So, you know, your spouse dies and you've got 20 years of them bouncing around in your memory and just sort of, you know, like the sadness, or sorry, any sort of pain that they've caused them probably, or caused you probably starts to fade away and you just sort of remember the good stuff. And, that sort of adds to, that's the way things go with Eazy-E in this movie, I find, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So speaking of kind of changing history, this movie, I mean, it doesn't lean on it too hard. It doesn't certainly make a point about it, but it does get across the fact that Eazy-E was, you know, the only real gangster, it seems. You know, he was the one dealing drugs and, you know, using that money to allow a lot of this music to be made.
Yeah.
And whereas Dre and Cube were kind of just high school kids,
yeah,
you know, teenagers making music and, you know, definitely grew up around a lot of violence. You know, I wouldn't question that. And I'm sure, you know, as you've said, I'm sure they've done some awful things. But the lyrics that we hear in these records aren't really a reflection of what they did with their lives.
No.
Did you think that was going to be displayed any differently?
No, I don't, because I don't, I do think that is something that it, that is kind of interesting about the movie, that it doesn't go out of its way to make specifically Dre and Cube try and seem tougher than they are. And it's like you said, they are around these things and these things happen in their neighborhood, but they're not necessarily like actual, you know, gangsters or anything like that. And that was interesting. I liked the scene, or I liked the fact that scene was there of Ice Cube trying, leaving Dr. Dre's house and trying to cross the street. And like that, I think that type of thing was interesting to have in the movie, to sort of show the way that police at that time in Los Angeles sort of affected their mind state, without having to show these characters be overly tough. Like Ice Cube doesn't have to punch the cops in the face and then get arrested and then get taken out of jail sort of thing. He just, he talks shit to the cops and then is let go eventually. And, it's a shitty thing to have to go through, but they don't Hollywoodize it too much, I don't find, you know?
Yeah. No, that's,
and like, they also don't go out of their way to make Cube look anything more than just sort of like a person, you know, like he really feels like a person in that movie that was just trying to cross his street and almost got arrested. Yeah.
Okay. Well, while we're on a positive tone, anything else you did like about this movie?
I thought Jason Mitchell, the guy that plays Eazy-E, I thought he was really good.
Yeah, he was good.
He gave a really good performance. And in a way that I felt like accurately represented my perception of Eazy-E as much as he could with the script being what it was. And also was like, I don't know, he came off as just weirdly human. And Eazy-E was always the person in NWA that seemed the least human. So just because, you know, he was like, Eazy-E was all persona and he had the weirdest voice. And, you know, he never wrote his own lyrics, all of these things. And yeah, I thought that was the thing that like both surprised me. And the thing that I liked the most was just his performance. I thought he was really great.
Okay.
Yeah.
Any other scenes or bits of filmmaking you enjoyed?
There's some good bits of filmmaking. Well, one or two. I especially like the long take scene where they're in a hotel room or whatever, and some guys come to the door, and you know, you go through that whole hotel party, and they go back to Eazy-E in the bathroom, and he comes out and gets a gun, and they go out the side door. That was all in a long take, and I thought that was pretty well done. That was kind of the one thing that really jumped out to me filmmaking wise, that they didn't have to do that way, but I thought made that scene much better.
Yeah, I thought so too. And it's, and you know, I know it's kind of, like in Goodfellas, you know, I know it's kind of a biopic in a way. There is that, you know, they often do, you know, like a long take scene, and it's really about, you know, the world they live in. And you always hear that in, you know, synopses of shows and movies and things like that, that it's about, you know, this world they inhabit. And I think that that's one thing that The Long Take accomplishes, is, you know, kind of walk around in their shoes for a bit, walk around in the actual place they're inhabiting, not just a couple camera shots. And, you know, you see how they party, you see what everyone else is doing.
Mm-hmm.
I did like that a bit. And I liked Paul Giamatti for being Paul Giamatti.
Yeah, yeah, of course. Of course.
And especially in that one scene, which I think was good for reasons other than him, when the cops were kind of shaking them down on their lunch break outside the studio there.
Yes.
That, I think, was kind of the most... I think one of the most effective scenes for me. And I think this movie is helped out by some, you know, fortunate and unfortunate timing of this theme of police and their treatment of mm-hmm. black, you know, predominantly black male, black youth in America right now. And I think that, you know, it was a theme that's obviously very prevalent in the movie and very prevalent in the music and the formation of NWA and so many of the things that they talked about. How do you feel about the timing of those things?
I think it is a combination of, and I don't use this word positively. I don't want it to sound like I mean it positively, but luck for them. And also Trayvon Martin's 2 years ago, right? So that there's probably some element of, you know, this is very much a part of something like the national conversation that's going on right now. And we can make a movie that simultaneously tells our story and also reflects what is happening now. And like you said, those are some of the more interesting moments in the movie, was pretty much the stuff featuring police. We didn't talk about the battering ram intro, you know, certainly over the top, but also I thought kind of did a good job of setting the stage for the movie. Pretty much anytime police are present in Straight Outta Compton, I found it pretty interesting.
Okay.
Yeah.
Do you want to talk about Compton, the album, at all?
Yeah, because I mean, it's kind of the same sort of thing. Like, and it really, you know, leaving Straight Outta Compton, you sort of end up thinking about the album as well, because the album comes out probably like a week before the movie. And a couple songs, like Talking to My Diary, is used a couple times. The game song is in the movie. And, you know, it's just present there. And according to Dr. Dre, the making of the album was basically inspired by being on set and thinking about his own memories and all that stuff. But the thing that bothers me about the album is that it sort of feels like, and I think John Caramonica said this, actually, New York Times music critic, knows a lot about hip hop. He said it often feels like Dr. Dre is a guest in his own house on the album. And I think that's a really good way of putting it, both production wise and rapping. He's really taking on this the modern style, basically the thing that Kendrick Lamar has sort of popularized, where every once in a while you have to rap really fast, you know, like, and Dre has never, ever done that in his career. And it really sounds like he's trying to keep up with the kids every time he does that, to me. And quite honestly, like, objectively, he doesn't do a terrible job at it. It sounds so bizarre for him to be trying it now, especially with this allegedly being his last album. It's just odd because, I mean, you know, Dre, we get different sounding Dres throughout his career. Like the Dre on Express Yourself and the Dre on The Chronic, the 1993 album, sound different, you know, but they're still sort of this slow, deep talking voice, basically. And same with 2001. And now you've really got him really adapting to the times in the way he raps, which is uncommon for him. It's always kind of been like a slight moderation on what he already did. And I feel like it just sounds odd to me, you know?
Yeah, well, and I think part of, I mean, this isn't NWA, but the Dre kind of G-funk sound is about it being so slow and so kind of laid back and mellow, no matter what the lyrical content is. If it's, mm-hmm. you know, something bigger and more aggressive, the sound always seemed kind of, you know, chill and laconic, and that, as you said, is not what he does on Compton so much.
Yeah, exactly. And the NWA, the two NWA albums are much more, you know, they sound like West Coast Public Enemy albums. I mean, the good stuff on Straight Outta Compton does. There's a lot of bad stuff on Straight Outta Compton. And E-Phil for Zagan, which is impossible to say, but I'm also not going to say the actual title. It is, in my eyes, like a better album front to back. Like, Straight Outta Compton has the higher highs, but yeah, the good stuff is all just West Coast Public Enemy, like very big, very loud, and very kind of, I've used this word to describe Ice Cube earlier, but boisterous. And when you get to the Chronic, Dre really sort of mellows out, and you know, it's sort of the slower pace sort of thing, and that exists in 2001 as well. And there is, you know, there's still sort of that slow pace to a lot of the songs on Compton, and it's just sort of when he tries to speed up that things don't really work for me.
Yeah. And I think it's worth noting that, you know, Dre does not, and, you know, he's been kind of open about it, but doesn't write a lot of his lyrics anymore. Yeah. And hasn't for a while, and uses a lot of ghostwriters.
He never has. He's never really written his own lyrics.
Right.
Yeah.
So, did you want to talk about that at all? And just kind of what a hip hop is so personal in its lyrics. And I don't mean, that it's the most, you know, secrets kind of thing, even though that can apply sometimes, but it's, you know, people don't cover hip hop a lot, or at least not seriously, because it's so personal. You're speaking from your perspective. You say your name an awful lot. Mm-hmm. Like, it's so, seems just very, very personal. And just the fact that he hasn't written his lyrics like that. Mm-hmm. Do you find that odd at all, or?
I'm going to say no. Like, it's always, because I, you know, as long as I've been a big hip hop fan, I've kind of known the whole ghostwriting thing. And it's been normalized to me for a long time in a way that I feel like most hip hop fans don't. I mean, we still have that whole, like, this was less than a month ago that Meek Mill says Drake doesn't write all his own lyrics. And it's like, of course he doesn't. He's a pop superstar, you know, like,
yeah.
And yeah, it's, and especially like the weird thing to me is how long this idea of ghostwriting being bad has been a part of hip hop culture, despite the fact that, everybody knew that Eazy-E didn't write his own lyrics, and everybody knew that Dr. Dre didn't write his own lyrics inside of one of the most important hip hop groups of all time, you know? And a group that, you know, is now almost 30 years ago. And we still have this mindset that rappers are supposed to write their own lyrics. But the thing that, makes it sort of not weird to me is that, I think the way that people approach rap is like, as listeners, is that, I think people take it more honestly than they should, specifically because there are more words in every rap song than there are in a Rolling Stones song, say. Like, it's easier to read a Rolling Stones song metaphorically simply because there are fewer details, so you get to fill in the gaps yourself. Whereas with rap music, there are so many more words per line, so many more words per verse, that you sort of start, you have more information, so you have fewer gaps to fill in on yourself, on your own, and so you get this more fully formed look at a person. And since you have more details, you kind of assume that you're getting more reality, which I don't think is the case. Like, I mean, if you just look through hip hop history, persona is so important. We've talked about it in the case of NWA. Like, their persona was so important, even though, you know, Eazy-E might have been the only one that was actually selling drugs, you know? And yeah, that's the thing that makes it not odd to me, is that hip hop is so persona based and pretty much always has been. Even with Run DMC, you know, you go back to one of the first most important groups of all time. They always had a persona of being tougher than they actually were. You know, like, DMC was always like yelling his lyrics, despite the fact that he spent all of his time sketching in his parents' basement. You know, like, it's so like un-hip hop, you know, like, and just going out of his way to seem tough, you know? And that's kind of always been, there's always been this conversation, or this quiet conversation going on with these artists and their lyrics. And that's why ghostwriting just isn't odd to me, you know?
And so do you think that has something to do with kind of more your problems with this movie being filmmaking based than a complete accurate retelling of history?
I'm not sure I understand what you mean.
Well, I mean, you didn't seem to be, I mean, it did seem to bother you a little bit that, you know, they weren't portrayed as badly as, you know, they likely were, you know, notably very misogynistic, homophobic, violent people. Mm-hmm. But that wasn't, you know, really dealt with in a very harsh way. That doesn't seem to be what bothered you about this movie. It was more just that it wasn't a good movie and it was just a checklist, as you say.
Yeah, exactly. You know, that it's like I said, that whole sort of, there was always a feeling of things being kind of lighter than they were, like the way that these characters actually, or these people actually were. Like, Ice Cube has made some of the most homophobic music you'll ever hear in your life. Like, it's unbelievable. Yeah. Like, I was listening to Death Certificate today, and there have got to be more F-bombs on that album than anything I've ever heard in my life. Yeah, and I mean, sorry.
I was just reading the lyrics to No Vaseline, which...
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's the last song on Death Certificate. So it's the real culmination of all the homophobia and misogyny that leads comes before it. But that's actually a more thoughtful album than this makes it sound like. But anyway, yeah, those things, I think I felt the misogyny was still kind of present, even though never directly addressed. Like, I think you see multiple women be thrown in the first scene, the battering ram scene. And also in the scene that ends with Ice Cube saying bye, Felicia, which is idiotic. But that sequence, women are not treated well either. But yes, you are right. There is never a direct address of it. But I probably would have hated a direct address of it as well. Like, I would have found it incredibly interesting if, say, the Dee Barnes incident was in the movie, because that's something we have so much information about. Not the whole story, but
enough.
Yeah, exactly. Certainly the majority of it.
And everybody involved with it agrees.
Exactly.
It's not,
exactly.
It's not a disputed account anymore.
No, exactly.
Well, but
yeah. Sorry.
Sorry. Do you think it's at all kind of disingenuous that the way this movie then, you know, as we'd said, kind of, you know, highlighting these things about the way police treat black people currently, you know, we talked about how it's still a very big part of the news, and to kind of whitewash over some of these, you know, very awful things that they were talking about?
Yes, I agree.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Were you kind of, I will just say that I was kind of let down in the music making scenes.
Oh,
and not
God,
just
so
in
bad.
The, I mean, you'd mentioned that you didn't like them in our brief discussion that we tried to keep brief to save it for the podcast. Mm-hmm. I think my complaint was that there was just very little kind of music making. Like, there was the rap, there was some interesting stuff the first time Eazy-E was in the booth and that whole conversation getting him in there and talking to him, and, you know, Dre just kind of wanting the best product by any means, and I think that's something interesting about him using ghostwriters all the time and you know, having so many other people on his album. It's kind of a meritocracy, like the best thing is gonna make it. I don't really care where it's coming from. So I thought that was an interesting scene for that angle as well.
Yeah,
but other than Dre listening to those records on the ground at the, you know, the first time we see him where he's lying on the carpet with the big headphones on listening to his music, there's nothing really about making the beats, which I think is something that was so interesting about Dre's career, is the beats that he makes, you know, since he's not writing these lyrics, and that he makes music that he doesn't rap on at all, his lyrics or not. I was really let down by him. You know, we don't get him kind of building a track at a point.
Yeah, and my main complaint about the way music making is shown throughout the movie is that it always takes approximately 30 seconds to come up with a finished version of your song in this film. You know, and
freestyles.
Yeah, exactly. Living Room Freestyles by Snoop. Just and then boom, we've got Let Me Ride. Print it. But yes, I agree, and I always find stuff like that really fascinating. Pretty much any time you see the process of making art in a movie, I find it interesting. Even that scene, that introductory scene with Dr. Dre that you mentioned, I really like that scene, and I think it's really difficult to show somebody listening to music and make it engaging. And I think even though, you know, there's not a lot of pizzazz to that scene, I thought it worked effectively. Just the choice of music that he was listening to, I don't even remember the song, but I was like, this feels really correct. This seems like something that Dre would have really been into at that age. I liked that scene. It really set him up as you know, the guy that cares about music. And but yes, you are correct. There was not enough showing of the actual music making, or a proper rendering of how music is actually made. Like, and especially with the Chronic, because the Chronic is so interesting because of how Dre built those beats. Like, there's so much live instrumentation on that album. That's what really makes it stand out. And that's what really made Dre stand out as a producer at that time, was that hip hop was so sample based, like all throughout its history. And Dre was really the first really popular person to be like, fuck it. Like, let's use instruments, you know, like we're still going to sample, but we're going to play those samples with it, like play them again. I believe the term is interpolation. And I think it saves you some money on the sampling, but, that's really what made, his music really, gives it that sort of the depth that, rap music often lacked. And that's what really makes the Chronic good, and what made it stand out then, and what still makes it stand out today. Like, if you listen to the Chronic right now, it sounds amazing. And it's over 20 years old, and same with Doggy Style. Like, they're both just, they have such depth to the music, and I would have loved to see that, you know, like, like the closest thing we get is Dre playing that Dre high-pitched keyboard thing, you know, and that's it.
Yeah, and it's terrible, because we know kind of what a perfectionist Dre is and how hard he does work, and mm-hmm. that he wakes up in the AM to compose the but it showed that, you know, their lives were kind of hard, but making music came easy to them. And mm-hmm. I think, you know, that's not true. I mean, I think it came easy to them in the sense that clearly Dre is very musically talented and has a gift for it, mm-hmm. but that their musical success came with a lot of hard work.
Yeah.
And it seems odd that we talked about how this movie kind of protects these estates and, you know, all these legacies and tries to make everybody look good. It seems like Dre would want some of his musical talent to be displayed a bit more than it was, and that the rappers, you know, worked hard on these things. Does mm-hmm. that not strike you as odd at all?
Yeah, it definitely is. And, I haven't been able to come up with an answer as to why not. And I think, like, the best answer that I can come up with is that, that rap persona sort of thing, where you want it to seem effortless all the time. And but I also think Dre is old enough that he probably doesn't care about that anymore, you know. Like, he might have not, if he's 26 and the Chronic's coming out, and he would have cared more about making sure it seemed effortless, you know, whereas now he probably shouldn't, and I doubt he does. But yeah, I have no reason for why it's not in the movie, you know.
Yeah. Well, and maybe the things he wants to protect are larger than that, like removing some of how awful he was towards people at that time in his life. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that just kind of the bigger legacy things that he is this legend, that this is where he came from, and not so much how many times he would try a different, you know, baseline to figure out the right one.
There's
bigger things involved in the legacy.
Yeah. Yeah.
True. Yeah.
And like, you know, as we're talking about it, like, it's something I would have liked to see in the movie and would have liked to see it done well. I don't necessarily know that the idea of Dre fiddling around on a bass line for 5 minutes is if there's an interesting way to capture that on film, you know?
Yeah.
It definitely sounds tricky. That might've just been why they cut it, 'cause it was just difficult, you know?
Yeah, well, it made him listening to music interesting, but yeah, I guess
that, and that is like tedious. A 5 second scene, though. You know, it's like we've got his name key on the screen, and him listening to music, And then like 30 seconds later, he's talking to his mom about how he doesn't want a job, basically.
Yeah, well, maybe all that stuff will be in the original 3.5 hour cut version.
Oh,
of the movie.
God, yeah, I cannot think of a movie I want to watch less than a 3.5 hour version of this.
You mentioned samples. Did you want to talk about samples at all? Because I think it's an interesting thing, and I know you've thought about it a lot. And just kind of thinking in the context of this movie, you know, we have this old story, and we're looking at it in a new way. Like, we don't have this perfect, accurate retelling. It's not a cover of the song, but it's kind of sampling moments of NWA history to make a cohesive, marketable media product.
Yeah.
Do you have a take on that?
Not really. I think you summed it up pretty well, because that's kind of what it is. It's a sampling of your own life, and then twisting and turning it and making it a $50 million opening weekend. Yeah.
Yeah. Are you excited for the sequels?
God, no. I find it really interesting, like, because the director, F. Gary Gray and Ice Cube, F. Gary Gray directed Friday. And
some videos and stuff. They've been together for a while.
Exactly. Like, it's like you, if you became incredibly famous tomorrow and then you hired me 20 years down the line to make a biopic about you, you know, like, it's just so, like, the whole project just fundamentally is just built on things I have problems with, you know, like I...
Very incestuous feeling.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Like these are people that know so much about each other, probably, but also really still care about these people, so that, like, feel... Like, are always just, even if it's subconsciously, are just going to paint these people in a positive light whenever possible, you know? And yeah. And that's why I just think, like, fundamentally the project is flawed, you know? Like, when you see directed by F. Gary Gray and then the three producer credits following the writers, they're just Dr. Dre, Ice Cube, and Tamika, I forget, I think she's got a hyphenated last name, but the last name would be Wright, half of it, in the credits. It's just like, yeah, this, I mean... It never had a chance to be interesting. You know?
Directed like, by this guy and written by his three friends.
Yeah, exactly. That's what it should have been.
Produced.
Directed by Ice Cube's longtime friend.
You got anything else about Straight Outta Compton or Compton?
No. I don't know. I don't know a lot about Compton, the city. Is.
I meant the album.
But. Oh, okay. Kendrick Lamar's third verse is on the album is one of my favorite verses in a long time. Everybody should check it out.
There you go. Do you think we're in a good place for hip hop now?
Yes, absolutely. Especially like, it's interesting that like, I find popular hip hop is sort of leaning in a much more experimental direction right now than it has been in a long time. I mean, if you just look at, like my two favorite albums of this year and two of my favorite albums the last like handful of years is Kendrick Lamar's To Pimp a Butterfly, which is this really interesting, well-constructed narrative that has like a start, a middle, and an end. Like the whole album is so wonderfully realized, and to the point where I almost never listen to like one song on that album. Like it's such a, you have to have like 70 minutes carved out to listen to the whole thing, because part like just single songs isolated a lot of times just aren't that enjoyable to listen to, because it's, he was so focused on making something interesting, and I love him for it. And it's also it all just sounds great. And I mean, we've been talking about Dre so much. Dre is involved in that project. He's not a credited producer on any song, I don't think, but it certainly sounds like something that sonically he has had a lot of input on. Like it just sounds so, it's got that depth I was talking about. And that's something that Kendrick Lamar cares very much about. And then you've also got, but that, you know, the, To Pimp a Butterfly and Kendrick Lamar in general is sort of this classic sort of rap artist, like this guy that writes and rewrites his lyrics over and over. And there's just this very strong structure in most of his songs that I really enjoy. And then you look at somebody like Vince Staples, who put out an album in June, an album that I love and sounds like the culmination of all these young rappers that I actually hate, but like he... Vince Staples, like Vince Staples does what Chance the Rapper does, like the sort of like free flowing music, but Vince Staples does it with a point and makes it really interesting. And I think like the, I mean, of all the songs in hip hop history, I think the song that ends the first half of Vince Staples' record is like one of the saddest hip hop songs I've ever heard in my life. Despite the fact that it's not like you know, there have been so many hip hop songs about people explicitly being murdered, you know, and this is just sort of, it's this moment of a guy realizing that nothing is going to be how it was. And it's just this really sad sounding song, and it's really great. And just the way Vince Staples makes music, he doesn't care about hip hop history and actively tries to push forward from it. And even though No ID, longtime famous hip hop producer, is basically the other guy working on this album, they really make this modern sounding record that sounds like the shards of hip hop history put back together to form something that's really modern and really interesting. And he's a good writer and a good rapper. And I think between those two, you know, it's just sort of hip hop's in a really adventurous place. And Vince Staples certainly isn't setting the world on fire sales wise, but it's great. And, you know, Drake, I think the fact that Drake is popular is, says something about the fact that hip hop is allowed to be experimental, because Drake makes really sort of musical stuff, you know? And I think when you see Drake's flaws is when he tries too hard to fall into rap imagery, like Worst Behavior. You know, that sounds like Drake trying to be what rap wants him to be, or what rappers used to be. And I find it really interesting that a really emotional rapper is able to be so popular. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, thanks for getting us in that beef with Chance the Rapper, by the way.
Yeah, exactly. well, I hate bucket hats too, and I think he wears them a lot. So, although
just because he wears a Kangol doesn't mean he's not LL.
Yeah. So thank you for listening to the MacGuffin Man. Be sure to check out Vince Staples' album, Summertime 06.
and Blade.
Yeah, exactly. And Blade in preparation for next week's podcast. Those two things are not related at all. There's no rave music on Vince Staples' record. Anyway, thank you for listening.
Thanks for listening to The MacGuffin Men. Be sure to check out themacguffinmen.com for supplementary links, articles, and more. Thanks for listening.